Good afternoon and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the Arizona Republic, the art of attraction. Draw hummingbirds to your garden with these plants by Paul Capiello. If you haven't been paying attention, hummingbirds are a thing. Actually, they've been a thing for a long time. There are whole websites devoted to tracking their spring migration north from their overwintering grounds in mostly southern Mexico and Central America. The first sighting of a ruby-throated hummingbird in the neighborhood is sometimes marked with reactions akin to Steve Martin's character in the 1979 cult hit movie The Jerk, screaming at the top of his lungs, "The new phone books are here! The new phone books are here!" But whether or not you are as vociferous about the return of your particular crop of hummingbirds, it's hard to deny that feeling, a bit like seeing an old friend after a long absence. There are also folks out there who just sit back and wait for something magic to happen. Might not have a single flower in the whole yard, but sit there, mint julep in hand, saying, why don't I have any hummingbirds like my neighbor down the street? Finally, there are some who would love to offer a bit of hummingbird service but don't want to commit to a giant garden that needs to be maintained. For those people, something as simple as a few annuals in pots can provide enough to attract a few birds, provide them some much-needed nourishment, and give you something to enjoy while you're sipping that julep. I won't get into the planted flowers versus well-maintained feeders in this column. I'll let you argue that one with your hummingbirdiest neighbors. But assuming you want to go the cultivated flower route, following are a few suggested varieties in alphabetical order. First on the list is Cufia. The so-called bat face might take some searching to find, but if you're in the market for plants that will make you the hands-down hummingbirdiest gardener in your neighborhood, this is one to consider. There are many Cufias, also sometimes known as cigar plant, and they all excel in the hummingbird realm. In my experience, they work better in large containers than in the ground. They are full sun plants and take well to midsummer cutbacks that can help to keep them tidy. Geraniums, pelargoniums. In one of the more annoyingly confusing plant nomenclature moves in the history of botanical nomenclature, what we all grew up with as a geranium is in fact the genus Pelargonium, not in the genus Geranium. Members of the genus Geranium are mostly herbaceous perennials that make superb garden plants in their own right, but they're generally not big hummingbird magnets. The Pelargoniums are those mostly brilliant red-flowered affairs your grandmother probably grew in pots in the summer and then overwintered on in windowsills. They love the sun, and they love the heat, and as long as you deadhead them regularly, they attract clouds of hummingbirds all summer long. Impatiens. Once an obligate shade plant, many of today's impatiens have been developed with seemingly bionic vigor and a love for the sun. And while their flowers don't have the typical tubular shape normally associated with hummingbird activity, the little guys love the impatiens. Impatiens don't require deadheading, produce masses of brightly colored flowers, and require only judicious watering to keep them happy. Lantana. Denizen of hot, sunny gardens, lantanas are flower machines, and the hummingbirds love them. There are large forms that will produce a cloud of stems, flowers, and foliage up to 4 feet tall or so. Some newer forms will stay closer to the ground and can even be small enough to make them good container selections. And if it ever gets too hot for you to grow lantanas, your best move is to Mars for the cooler weather. Nicotiana. The so-called flowering tobaccos are excellent hummingbird selections. While not great for containers, they perform admirably in good garden beds, offering sweetly scented flowers all summer long. Some top out at 4 or 5 feet tall, while others stay around a foot in height. Petunias. It's hard to deny the flower power of a well-grown petunia planting. And the geometry of a petunia flower is perfect for the hummingbird's anatomy. They will slurp up the nectar and keep coming back as long as the plants have flowers. And don't be fooled by the assertions that red flowers are all the bomb for hummingbirds. Most research has shown that hummingbirds prefer flowers with the best and most nectar, regardless of petal color. Salvias. Pretty much any salvia will be a hands-down winner in attracting and feeding hummers. The annual salvias, including red salvia, are brilliant hummingbird selections regardless of flower color. Like petunias, they are screaming hot sun plants, so make sure they're getting plenty of sun and plenty of water to keep them producing all summer long. The Texas native scarlet salvia is technically a perennial in the south, but in central and northern latitudes can be grown as a summer annual crop. Zinnias, another annual that might not at first look like the typical hummingbird flower, zinnias come in a wide range of brilliant colors, make great cuts for bringing indoors, and can attract clouds of hummingbirds. Sun, sun, and sun. Here's another article that appeared recently in the Arizona Republic. Love them or fear them, take tips for dealing with bees by Greg Giesen. They're spotted on flowers or buzzing around soda cans. They're bees, and they can be seen just about everywhere every spring. According to the Delaware Department of Agriculture, there are more than 4,000 different species in North America. Some of the more common among them are bumblebees. The large, hairy, black and yellow insects are excellent pollinators. Sweat bees. These bees are often brown or black and occasionally have gray stripes. Some are metallic green. They are great crop pollinators. Carpenter bees. They look like bumblebees and are good pollinators, but they don't live in hives. Rather, they live in burrowed out wood. So what to do if stung? According to the Mayo Clinic, most bee stings can be treated at home. Here are treatment tips for minor or moderate bee stings. Move to a safe area to avoid additional stings. If a stinger is visible sticking out of the wound, it looks like a black dot, remove it as soon as possible. If the stinger is below the skin, leave it. It will come out as the wound heals. Wash the sting area with soap and water. Ice the area or use a cold pack for 10 to 20 minutes. Repeat as necessary. If the sting is on an arm or leg, raise it to reduce swelling. If stung on a finger with a ring, immediately remove the ring before the area swells. Use hydrocortisone cream or calamine lotion to ease itching and swelling. If needed, take a pain reliever. Multiple stings or an allergic reaction may be a medical emergency that needs treatment right away. How to get rid of bees? There are several natural repellents that can keep bees away. Citronella candles do more than just repel mosquitoes. Bees do not like the scent either. Vinegar. Spray a mixture of vinegar and water in equal parts around the area where the bees are spotted. The scent will deter them. Smoke. Bees are sensitive to smoke and will abandon the area. Cinnamon. Sprinkle the spice around the hive and the scent can make the bees relocate. A beekeeper or a pest control person can also be called to remove a hive. Why people shouldn't kill bees. Bees play a key role in the ecosystem and food supply, feeding on nectar and pollen from flowers, the U.S. Forest Service said. The pollinators have been in decline amid factors like climate change, habitat destruction and fragmentation, pesticides, invasive species, and disease, according to the National Wildlife Federation, prompting renewed conservation efforts. If people prefer to plant a bee-friendly garden, they should aim for a diverse range of flowering plants, including native plants, the Michigan Pollinator Initiative at Michigan State University said. Bee-friendly plants, according to the Nature Conservancy, Beverly Bees Heritage Conservancy, Michigan Pollinator Initiative, and Dennewith's Garden Center in Michigan, include native wildflowers, black-eyed Susan, American lotus, blazing star, marsh marigold, culver's root, wild bergamot, prairie smoke, New England aster, bladderwort, wild columbine, common trillium, bloodroot, wild lupine. Trees, black cherry, red maple, black locust, willow, silky dogwood, eastern redbud, American wild plum, basswood, winged sumac, black gum. Fruits, blueberry, apple, raspberry, tomato, watermelon, strawberry, blackberry. Herbs, basil, sage, thyme, oregano, and mint. Shrubs, elderberry, black haw, serviceberry, buttonbush, widderberry. Flowers, sunflower, tulip, rose, cornflower. Vegetables, cucumber, pumpkin, broccoli, and squash. From AOL.com, a two-month project transforms this boring backyard spot into a gardener's dream by Sarah Everett. Whether you're working inside or outside, sometimes completing one home project gives you the momentum, confidence, or do-it-yourself know-how to complete another one shortly after. Do-it-yourselfer Dina McMahon says she hopes her backyard transformation is only expanded on in the future. She wants to add even more raised beds. Over the span of 2 months, she added raised garden beds and a potting table to her yard. I've always wanted to grow my own vegetables and flowers in my backyard, and as I was staining my new fence, I imagined it and started to bring my ideas to life, she says. This area of our yard was unused space, so it was the perfect opportunity to build my garden. As mentioned, Dina started by staining the fence in a semi-transparent stain that she had color matched to Benjamin Moore's ranch wood. Once that was done, she built a potting table against the fence. She spent about $100 on lumber and used the same ranch wood paint color left over from a previous project. She built a base out of bricks to go underneath the table and then added 2x4s plus a little bit of extra wood from her fence to help secure the table to the two large posts in her fence. Dina had a bit of extra lumber once the table was built, so she built a rail with hooks, a potting tray, and a bench for weeding. I couldn't waste any of those cut-off ends, Dina says on Instagram. I hate wasting scraps. After building the table, Dina removed the grass and topped 3 inches of soil, laid down landscape fabric as a weed barrier, and added pea gravel with heavy lifting help from her husband and 2 sons to create a surface for her raised beds to sit on. The hardest part was the manual labor, she says. One of her proudest accomplishments in the garden is the upcycled edging. I kept some of the old fence boards that weren't rotten and cut them down to 8 inches and pounded them into the ground, overlapping them to create a barrier for the pea gravel and define the garden space, she says. Dina had a bit of professional help with tapping into the McMahon's existing irrigation system to add a separate line for the irrigation to the raised beds, plus a hose bib. This cost about $500. The hose is from Garden Glory, and the raised beds are from Sprout Box Gardens. Adding those on top of the pea gravel, adding soil inside, and then planting seeds completed the project. I adore my new garden, Dina says. It's such a productive space in our yard rather than just grass. Nothing more gratifying than heading outside to pick veggies for dinner. Dina says she looks forward to expanding her garden this summer, and she even added new pavers and a greenhouse. From BetterHomesAndGardens.com, it's corpse flower season again. Here's where to go to see the rare plants bloom. Another funky flower is about to open at any moment and will only last a few days, by Sophia Beams. After last year's incredible Washington, D.C. corpse flower showing, where 2 of these rare flowers bloomed almost at the same time, gardeners and tourists alike have been waiting with bated breath to see when and where the next corpse flower blossoms will appear in 2025. A new corpse flower is expected to open any day now at the Missouri Botanical Garden. The garden anticipates that its corpse flower, affectionately named Lucy, will unfurl sometime between now and the 3rd of June. So what's so special about corpse flowers? Corpse flowers, also known as Titan arums, produce one of the largest inflorescences in the plant world, reaching heights between 9 and 12 feet tall. Once a corpse flower opens, it may last as little as a single day and up to 3 days before it withers. Visitors who are hoping to view the corpse flower open in Missouri will need to time their visit perfectly because Lucy will likely close again within a few days. Besides its impressive size, rarity, and striking color, the scent of the corpse flower is almost ironically what draws in its adoring fans because it's not exactly a pleasant fragrance. The stench of rotting flesh is at its strongest during the first day of bloom. This powerful odor is how the plant attracts pollinating bugs from far and near. So how to see Lucy bloom for yourself? The Missouri Botanical Garden has Lucy on display in the Climatron Observatory. Once the plant blooms, you can visit during regular hours to see it for yourself. Just keep in mind that the standard garden admission applies. The website recommends ordering your tickets in advance. General admission for the day costs $16. St. Louis City and County residents can enter for a discounted rate, and the gardens are open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. daily. Corpse flowers take about 7 years to produce their first flower and will only rebloom every 2 or 3 years after that. Seeing a corpse flower in real life is a rare occasion, especially since they're considered endangered, with fewer than 1,000 plants still existing in the wild. Unless you're growing a corpse flower in your own greenhouse, visiting the Missouri Botanical Garden is your next best bet to experience this amazing plant for yourself. Also from BetterHomesAndGardens.com, 9 challenging vegetables to grow that are totally worth it. These veggies demand more attention, but their homegrown flavor is worth the extra effort, by Lauren Landers. Some vegetables are so easygoing that you can grow them in full sun or light shade and harvest their stems, leaves, or roots just a few weeks after planting. However, other vegetables are pickier about their growing requirements and can potentially take years to produce an edible harvest. However, with a bit of know-how and the right growing conditions, even beginning gardeners can grow these challenging vegetables to enjoy their delicious homegrown flavors. First on the list, asparagus. Planting asparagus is an investment in the future of your garden, as these slow-growing plants can take years to reach harvestable size. When growing asparagus from seed, plan to wait about 4 years before enjoying a harvest. However, you can harvest asparagus spears about 2 to 3 years after planting if you grow asparagus from crowns instead of seeds. These plants require a lot of space in the garden, but interplanting asparagus with fast-growing herbs such as cilantro and parsley can keep your growing space productive while you wait for your bounty of spears. Celery is second on the list. Celery grows best in cool, moist weather and doesn't fare well in hot conditions. Heat and water stress can turn these plants bitter or cause them to develop hollow or stringy stems that aren't pleasant to eat. To avoid this, sow celery seeds early in the season, keep the plants well watered and mulched, and shelter them with shade cloth during periods of high heat. And a tip, celery needs about 1 to 2 inches of water per week, sometimes more during the hottest weather. Cauliflower, number 3. Cauliflower plants are also highly sensitive to heat and can bolt in hot weather or develop stunted or misshapen heads that don't look anything like you'd find at the grocery store. Fortunately, you can avoid bolting by starting cauliflower early in the spring or in midsummer for an autumn harvest and prevent most buggy issues by growing cauliflower under row covers. Like other brassicas, cauliflower plants are particularly susceptible to pests that feed on the plant's leaves and damage the cauliflower heads. Be on the lookout for cabbage lubers, aphids, and cutworms. Even deer and rabbits will munch on the seedlings and plants if given the chance. Number 4, Brussels sprouts. One of the most common issues gardeners encounter when growing Brussels sprouts is that their plants perform poorly and produce undersized sprouts. This is usually due to temperature issues, but it can also be caused by growing Brussels sprouts in small containers or in poor quality soil that lacks sufficient nutrients for these hungry plants. To produce larger sprouts, enrich your garden beds with compost before planting, fertilize the plants regularly, and sow Brussels sprouts seeds early in the season so they have time to grow before the hot weather arrives. And a tip, if you live in a warm winter area, plant Brussels sprouts in the fall and harvest them as a spring crop. Sweet potatoes, number 5. Sweet potatoes are usually grown from slips, which are highly sensitive to cold weather and should only be planted outdoors several weeks after your last spring frost. Unfortunately, this means the sweet potatoes may not have enough time to reach a harvestable size before fall if you live in an area with a short growing season. To speed things along, start sweet potato slips indoors in spring and transplant them into soil amended with compost to give your plants more energy to grow. And a tip, in areas with cool summers, cover the planting area with black plastic and plant the slips through slits in the plastic, which warms the soil and speeds development. Heading lettuce, number 6. Most types of lettuce bolt in hot weather, but this tendency is more pronounced in heading type lettuces such as romaine and iceberg. If you don't get these plants in the ground early enough in spring, or if hot weather strikes unexpectedly, your lettuce plants won't form heads and they'll turn bitter. If you live in a hot climate, slow down bolting by starting lettuce seeds as early as possible, positioning plants in light shade, and watering often. Number 7 is sweet corn. Different varieties of corn can sometimes cross-pollinate with each other and produce cobs and kernels that aren't tasty. Growing only one type of corn in your garden can avoid this issue, but it's still crucial to plant corn the right way. These plants are wind-pollinated and often require growing in large groups or squares to ensure proper pollination. They may also require fencing or other supports to keep their stalks from toppling over in high winds. Artichokes, number 8. Like asparagus, artichokes are one of the few vegetable crops that grow perennially. These slow-growing plants usually don't produce their edible flower buds until their second or even third year of growth. Artichokes require a lot of space in the garden, and they're not particularly cold-tolerant, which means you might need to provide them with winter protection or skip growing them entirely if you live in a cold climate. Number 9, onions from seed. Onions are typically grown from sets or pre-started plants for earlier harvesting, but they can be grown from seed if you don't mind waiting a little longer and investing more time in your onion crop. The problem is that onion seeds often have poor germination rates, so it's essential to overseed when planting, replace onion seeds annually, and increase airflow in indoor grow rooms to protect onion seedlings from damping off. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories from the terrific book called Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This one is called The Golden Girls. It was written by Linda O'Connell. And there's a quote here from Peter Bodo. There is no security quite as comfortable and undemanding as the kind you feel among old friends. The Golden Girls. Rose and I met when we were in our mid-20s. I'd invited her daughter to my daughter's third birthday party, and Rose came along. We scrutinized each other and assessed the obvious differences. She was a smoker. I wasn't. I dressed conservatively. She didn't. She wore a long, black, flowing wig whenever she tired of her short, frosted hair. I wore the same flip hairstyle for years, but we became best friends. Despite our differences, we wore a path from my house to hers, sometimes in our fuzzy robes, borrowing sugar, guzzling coffee, sharing baked goods and details of our lives. For 12 years, we went to yard sales, fast food restaurants, playgrounds, and school events together. Rose and I stayed best friends during tough times as well. Both of us had turbulent marriages. One summer, both marriages finally fell apart. Coincidentally, Rose's sister Millie ended her marriage about the same time, and so did Rose's childhood friend Judy. The four of us became known as the Golden Girls. We discovered a neighborhood club with an outdoor patio, and we spent that summer sipping soda and dancing together to old-time rock and roll. After that summer, we calmed down a bit. As we created new lives for ourselves, we saw less of each other. Eventually, Rose and I attended each other's weddings, and we visited together at family gatherings and holiday celebrations. Each time, it was as if we'd never been apart. At my daughter's baby shower, I noticed that Rose's one-of-a-kind laugh seemed hoarse. She told me she'd had a persistent cough for weeks. Soon, diagnostic tests indicated a mass in her lung. Exploratory surgery revealed a large inoperable malignancy. I visited Rose in the intensive care unit afterward. "I love you," I told my friend, realizing it was the first time I had said the words aloud. "I love you too," she said groggily, sealing our bond. After Rose recovered from surgery, I took her for radiation treatment. We held hands in the waiting room. When our eyes met, they brimmed with tears. On the drive home, we talked about this life and the afterlife. And we talked about a story we'd both read many, many years before about two friends, one of whom was terminally ill. "You'll remember that story, won't you?" Rose asked. "I will," I promised. The Golden Girls reunited. Millie, Judy, and I spent countless hours with Rose. We took her shopping and dining. We humored her when her medication gave her hallucinations. When she became incapacitated, we visited her at home in shifts. I fluffed her pillows, brought her donuts, massaged her feet, and colored in coloring books with her. Rose spent the last week of her life in the hospital, heavily sedated, surrounded by loved ones. At 51, her breathing ceased, and our mourning began. A year followed, and I thought of Rose often. One cold November morning as I left for work, I saw something pink protruding from a drift of decaying leaves. I cleared the debris and gasped in disbelief at a flower bud. During the summer, I had planted a tiny 3-inch potted azalea, hoping it would grow into a bush. It hadn't grown at all and had never flowered. But here on this frosty Missouri morning, with the rest of the garden killed by a hard frost, the azalea bloomed. I thought about Rose all day, and that afternoon, I called her daughter. "Denise, can you come by after work?" I asked. "I have a surprise from your mom." When I got home, I checked the azalea again. The tiny pink bud had opened completely and blossomed to the size of a carnation. That evening, Denise came to my door. She looked just like Rose. "You're not going to believe this," I said. I told Denise about the conversation Rose and I had had after her radiation therapy. 20 years ago, your mom and I read a story about two best friends. One was terminally ill. She vowed to make a flower bloom in winter to prove there was an afterlife. Your mom and I discussed that story and made a pact that day. I led Denise to the backyard and showed her my azalea blooming in winter. Denise and I laughed, embraced, stared in disbelief, and cried tears of joy. "This couldn't have come at a better time," Denise said, wiping her eyes. "It's been almost a year since Mom passed away. You've taken away so much of my sadness. Thank you." During the next week, I watched in amazement as three more flowers bloomed fully. I called Millie and Judy and told them about the plant I nicknamed the Golden Girls, with one blossom for each of us. We rejoiced at the message from our friend. Incredibly, the plant thrived for 2 weeks, surviving snow, wind, and chill. And then the flowers gradually withered and died, completing the cycle of life. But they left behind a vivid memory and a message for all us Golden Girls that true friendship never dies. That's called The Golden Girls, written by Linda O'Connell, one of the many stories that make up chicken soup for the gardener's soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy. And we'll be talking with you soon.